The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello, and you're very welcome along to the programme for this Thursday, the 16th of July, 2026. It's just 4 minutes past nine, and we're all set for a busy 2 hours here on The Greg Hughes Show. Loads coming up in the programme. Thank you so much for keeping us so busy on the text lines, the phone lines. Sometimes, you know, back in the day, you would see a dip in the summer. Maybe things are changing now. Just a dip in how people engage with the radio and all that type of thing, but not anymore. It's not like that. We're flat out all year round now, and there's a whole host of comments that I'm carrying over that I'll get to over the course of the next 2 hours, because they're all very important, and it's time for you now to get involved in the show. Here's how you do so. WhatsApps and texts to 086 60 25,000, and don't forget your WhatsApp voice notes on any issue can come into that number as well, 086 60 25,000. You can always give us a call if you just want to speak to a good old human, 074 91 25,000. And if email is your preferred way of communicating, it's comments at highlandradio.com. And of course, if you're listening to the overnight replay, we really appreciate you being on board. You can WhatsApp and email, we'll pick them up for the next live show. That goes for the podcast as well, by the way. And just to let you know, in relation to the Greg Hughes podcast, it's the sister podcast to this show. Last week's podcast, just in case you missed it, is Colin and Ethna Bell. Very sadly, they lost their son, Kevin, whilst he was living his best life in New York. He was killed in a hit-and-run collision. And from that, the Kevin Bell Repatriation Trust was formed, and it has helped 2,500 people return home having lost their lives abroad. And you can multiply that by factors, many factors, to get to how many people that has touched. And there's not a community listening this morning that someone hasn't been repatriated through that trust. It's really quite a remarkable thing, and they really are quite remarkable people. So just in case you missed it or you're tuning in for the first time, please feel free to check it out. It's on our website, or you can just search The Greg Hughes Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and there's a million ways to listen to them nowadays. So there is. Right, let's get to the Chuck Connell Tribune. We knew that there was a significant overrun on the four lanes, and I thought it was in and around the 12 or 13 million euro mark. But the Tricolor Tribune's acquired the final figures. A final report on the cost of the N56 four-lane road in Letterkenny. So if you're outside Letterkenny, that's the four lanes literally coming into Letterkenny from the Derry side, with the concrete bollard going up the middle. Well, it's in Letterkenny, it's revealed that the initial 10.9 million construction cost agreed in 2021 has jumped by 47%. That road, can you believe, that road cost... Let me read this again. A final report on the cost of the N56 four-lane road in Letterkenny has revealed that the initial 10.9 million construction cost agreed in 2021 has jumped by 47% to 5.1 million to a final figure of 16 million that was signed off earlier this year. So the initial construction, 10.9, an additional 5.1, you'd wonder where that came from. And the entire project cost 16 million euro. At the time that was being built, I was speaking to a lovely gentleman, a listener, who was going to his wedding back in the 70s, and he got stuck on the four lanes. And to all intents and purposes, it is exactly what it was then. So really, 16.1 million euro or 16 million euro was spent putting that concrete bollard up the middle. And cycle lanes that arguably aren't used really as much as they should. I was behind cyclists on it there the other day. And also we have a situation whereby emergency services are not able really to get around the traffic on it. So this all cost us 16 million euro. That's a lot of money, a real big chunk of cash. At Tuesday's municipal district meeting, Councillor Kieran Brogan received an updated report on the four-lane project when he saw answers on the total money spent and what plans were being made to implement or improve access for emergency services. I received a video there the other day and actually forgot to highlight it. I might do that a little later on, just to emphasise the problems for emergency vehicles. And you know it's bad when the rally's on and they have to shut down another road for emergency services, right? You know that's proof that the system's not working, because they have to close another road for public use to facilitate. But 16 million euro, and does anyone or any organisation need to be held account for that? Or maybe it's money well spent. I'm just saying, reflecting what listeners say to me. Residents, business people, schools and community groups in Lough Innure are calling for urgent action to tackle speeding on the N56, warning that it's only a matter of time before a serious accident occurs if measures are not introduced. This is the Donegal News. The middle of the Lough Innure village is governed by a 50-kilometre speed limit, but locals say many motorists are failing to adhere to it, creating a significant safety concern for pedestrians, businesses and road users. But we're being told as part of the road traffic review that a lot of these issues may well be addressed, but still that fight goes on. Another fight goes on, potentially, between the state and fuel protesters. Now, there were fuel protests in this country, of course, when prices skyrocketed and people literally couldn't afford to put petrol and diesel in their cars, and businesses were affected by it. And, you know, the people of Ireland went out and protested. But it keeps coming up as if it's going to happen again, or as if this is an ongoing thing, to the point where the Irish Daily Mail reports that Garda chiefs have hired tow truck firms from the north to break up any fuel protest blockades targeting the Irish EU presidency after one of the force's main providers refused to cross pickets earlier this year. The cross-border companies will join the Defence Force's heavy-duty Beast vehicles on standby as the main line of defence against demonstrations aimed at disrupting EU events. Justin Kelly told the Oireachtas Transport Committee yesterday that contingency plans have been drafted by Garda should protests break out. Now, what I don't understand, and please, if someone can explain, why they are conflating the fuel protests with demonstrations aimed at disrupting EU events. I don't understand the connection, or maybe there's information or a news story that I missed. It's possible that people might want to protest the EU events, but they're saying it would be fuel process, and maybe I'm thick. In fact, I'm quite sure I almost am, but I don't understand the connection between the fuel protests and potential protests of the EU presidency. But anyway, I'm not sure if you've travelled Ryanair with a disability. I know people that choose not to, that they will pay the often extra charges to fly with Aer Lingus because they believe it's a better system for travelling in a wheelchair, for an example. But a Ryanair passenger, and this is in the Irish Independent, a Ryanair passenger has said his disabled brother was carried off a plane like a sack of potatoes after SAF said his electric wheelchair could not be accommodated in the hold, despite the same chair having travelled on a previous flight without difficulty. Daranta Mara and her brother Jaroslaw, my eyes aren't working properly today, were due to fly from Dublin to Rocklaw on July 10th to visit family in Poland. Mr. Kula suffered an injury 4 years ago following a spinal cord abscess, leaving him paralysed from the neck down and needing full-time care. And they said he was treated like a sack of potatoes. So really, just I'm throwing it out there, a lot of people travel with a disability. I'm just curious if that's something you've experienced, particularly with that airline. The Farmers Journal: just one third of farmers challenges against Department of Agriculture scheme decisions were successful with the Agricultural Appeals Office in 2025. That success rate is the joint lowest level since 2024. Of the 167 appeals which had some success, only 80 were finally allowed. Some 69 cases were settled by a revised department decision. That's the lead in the Farmers Journal. Just as a follow-up, because I kind of like to, you know, whatever happens in terms of e-scooters, and I'm not obsessed by them at all, don't get me wrong, but, you know, this feels like, you know, a big change in how roads are used. And that's why I'm giving you a follow-up in relation to that. We heard yesterday from medical professionals that say in the lack of enforcement or safety measures, they would back an e-scooter ban. The Taoiseach said something similar. Now, the Gardaí have weighed in. The Garda Commissioner said yesterday he would absolutely support an outright ban on e-scooters on Irish roads. Well, of course he would. Justin Kelly's comments come the day after the Taoiseach told the Dáil he's leaning towards a full ban on the public use of the vehicle. Mr Kelly appeared before the Oireachtas Committee on Transport and was asked by Chairman Michael Murphy whether a complete ban on public roads and in public spaces would be his preferred option for regulating e-scooters. And he said yes. I mean, but what about all the people that spent hundreds of euro on these? Can you imagine the value of property that would be wiped out in an instant? These things would become absolutely useless. And I'm sure there's companies as well that have invested in e-scooters, etc. You might remember going back, we have quite regularly Paddy Tobin on this programme, and a couple of years back he was on and he was just about to, or had just taken time off from the Dáil to deal with a skin cancer diagnosis, and thankfully for him, it has been successful treatment. But obviously he has an interest in this space, and he says and accuses the government of placing a tax on skin cancer prevention as customers are forced to pay the standard rate of VAT on sunscreen, which actually makes an awful lot of sense. Why, when we're being encouraged to use it so much, why would we be paying, charging so much VAT on it? Well, AIM2 leader Paddy Tobin is calling on the government to use its EU presidency to seek an agreement for 0% VAT on sunscreen products. It's taxed at the standard tax rate of 23%, with the cost of sunscreen varying from €8 to more than €20 for a 200 milliliter bottle. So there you go. It is the kind of thing that doesn't need a tax on. What do you think? 086 60 25,000. Beach etiquette. A few people messaged in relation to this over the last couple of days. Greg, I'm astonished that in this day and age, parents are letting their children wander around beaches totally naked. This is an interesting one because I was at the beach the other day, and there was a family playing, and they were having amazing fun. And that was it. That's all I noticed, to be honest with you. I never noticed anything else. But then an older gentleman approached the mother and said, I could only hear from a distance, said that, do you not think you should put some clothes on your toddler? The toddler was naked. And I don't know what happened. I don't know how. I don't know. It's up to you. Would you ever approach someone and say that to them? I certainly wouldn't. I don't know how it went down. I don't know what the mother said in return either. But it was at that point then that I did notice the toddler had no clothes on. I was oblivious to it, to be honest with you. But the old guy, the older guy, certainly wasn't. And he obviously was of the view that the toddler should have clothes on. But it never crossed my mind. I don't even know what I think, to be honest with you. I mean, all I know is we were raised quite prudish, right? So it would be for that reason that I would make sure Hudson had trousers on him or something, right? But it's only because I was sort of raised that way, if you know what I mean. But I just thought it was a very interesting interaction for someone to come up to a family and say that. And as I say, all I saw was a family having fun. But this other person seen something else and was clearly offended by it. But this texter says, Greg, I'm astonished that in this day and age, parents are letting their children wander around beaches totally naked. Please, parents need to wise up and protect their children from perverts. Please act a little more responsibly. What do you think about that? I don't know. I really don't know. There's always going to be people. You see, this is the thing. Like, if someone is that way inclined to look at your child that way, I'm not sure, does it matter if it's clothed or unclothed? I don't know. I don't know what to say to that. I just know that people are actually going up to people, because I witnessed myself, and telling them to put clothes on their children. And there's a listener that says, you know, you need to protect your children. Or is that the society we want to live in? I really don't know. Help me make up my mind as to what the situation is in that whole. As I say, I'm oblivious to it. I just see a family. But other people see different things. But then again, it's not something I would do with our boys. So I don't know. 086 60 25,000. And would you go up and say something to someone? And why would you? Or have you had someone come up and say that to you? And what's your view? See, I just see the innocence of it. Whereas I don't know if I want my mind to start seeing seeing it being as something wrong, because what does that say about society and us as humans? But maybe I'm being naive. So please help us out. 0749 125 000 or 086 60 25 000. Why have some young people no respect anymore for themselves or anyone else? Has to be something done to stop this from happening again. That's a reaction to younger people messing about on the beach. But it's not just the beach where it can be left in a state. Was out walking after six on Saturday morning in the car park at McDonald's in Letterkenny that runs down by Holmestore Mall was an absolute disgrace. Take away pizza boxes, bags, cans and bottles. There's no excuse, as there's bins located at this car park. It wasn't as bad at rally time. Yeah, I wonder how much of that is ever present, and maybe someone in Tidy Towns, wherever you are, whichever Tidy Towns organisation you're a part of. I think often for me anyway, this is all cleaned up by the time I'm out on the road. Maybe this is happening every single night in towns and villages up and down the county. I don't know. And maybe it just so happened that you saw that morning. Maybe we can get an insight. 086 60 25 000. Greg, regarding the World Cup, what are your thoughts on the ex-Spanish Prime Minister saying France has no French players on their team and should be thrown out of the tournament? Well, as I say, there's a record number of players not from the world, from their own country playing in the World Cup. I think that's just the way it's going to be now. It was said in Coronation Street Soap last month that Spain or Argentina would win the World Cup. Spain is a very good team. I backed them from the start. Right, okay. Whoever is writing in writing for Coronation Street probably knows something that we don't. This is before the game. I hope England win, but I have a feeling that the decision will go against England. Yeah, England were well beaten last night. I feel sorry for the manager. Do I feel sorry for him? No, he's worth an absolute fortune. It was crazy what he did, wasn't it? Going defensive against Argentina, 1-0 up. Attack is the best form of defence sometimes. Putting on a ton of defenders, falling back, giving up the midfield to Argentina, saying, come on, lads, have a go. And yet Argentina had proved time and time again that you can't give them that kind of space. It was crazy. He was actually brought in because the last manager was too defensive, and he was brought in to beat these teams and to be more attack-minded. And then he defaulted to the old English way of parking the bus. They all fell back, invited Argentina onto them, and the rest is history. 64 years of hurt incoming. A caller said, though, we really should have been backing our neighbours. Come on, England, they say. Let's go now to Kevin O'Brien of the Variety, the Children's Charity of Ireland. Good morning to you, Kevin. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, Greg. Hope you're well.
Yes, all good here in the Northwest. And it's going to be enhanced further with the official launch of the Northwest of Ireland Hub for Variety Ireland. It's going to take place on Saturday, the 25th of July, 10:30 a.m. In Turban, Creevin, more specifically. Northwest of Ireland Hub for Variety Ireland?
Thanks, Greg. Well, look, it's a massive day for Donegal and everything else that goes with it, because we're introducing a brand new cycling, inclusive cycling hub. And this is a place where people with additional needs can actually come and actually cycle on a full range of inclusive disability bikes. And again, the reason, the whole idea behind this is to basically get people out cycling, learn to cycle with their peers and everything else, so they can actually have fun. It's good for the mental and physical well-being of the people and also the family as well.
And how sort of adaptable are these bikes and trikes?
Well, we have wheelchair bikes, a full range of hand bikes. So if someone is visually impaired, it doesn't mean that they can't go on a bike. We have tandem bikes, so people can experience them. Obviously, Greg, remember when you first cycled your own bike, the experience it was great fun and great crack. So we're trying to bring, you know, everyone together now. And first of all, get them to learn to cycle in a safe environment. So if they can learn, it's a mapped out track with road signs, everything else. And so people can come along, they can be on a wheelchair bike, they can be on a hand bike, which is cycled themselves, or they can be on a range of different mobility trikes. But the whole idea is to get them used to cycling. And then obviously after that, then if they want to go out cycling, they'll have that bit of experience and know-how how to do it. But it's about bringing communities together as well, you know?
Yeah, indeed. And for some people, Kevin, or maybe it's the majority, is it because, you know, some of this equipment is quite specialist? It would be the first time they will be able to cycle. What's that like for them and their families, and I suppose you guys in the charity?
Well, for us, like as I said, it's a volunteer-run charity. We don't have paid CEOs or directors or anything else like that. So what we basically do, we work closely with the HSE, the Department of Transport, the Department of Children. And in this case, we're partnering with Donegal County Council. And what we do is we're getting these bikes in there. And for children, when they come along, there's a bike for nearly for 99% of people, children or adults who come along to the centre to cycle. We've opened these up. We opened up the first one in Collinstown in Dublin 22 back in November of last year. There's over 1,000 people passing through that every week now. And that's people from visually impaired, people in wheelchairs. And they're getting that cycling experience. It's the excitement. It's the fun. And, you know, we have a saying here, it's not that they're entitled to this, but they deserve it. And that's what we work hard as a charity to make sure. We opened up a hub, one of these hubs in Manola in County Mayo 2 weeks ago, where the Donegal's opening week on Saturday. Then we're going over to Louth. We're going down to over to Galway then. Then we're going down to, there's two more opening in Dublin, one in Kerry and Cork. So we want to try and bring these around the country. So everyone has the fun, gets to experience cycling because it's something we all remember as a child. And, you know, we see as a charity, it's important to us that everyone not talk about inclusivity, actually action inclusivity.
Yeah. And maybe I'm missing this, but this isn't a roadshow. This is a permanent installation, is it?
Oh, permanent installation, yeah, okay. 150% where people can come. We work close with the HSE. And what we're going to be doing is, I mean, the grassroots, brilliant people up there. I mean, they give people the opportunity to cycle. And we're going to be putting where people, disability groups can come. This is what we're putting it at when we get the launch done, put into action where disability groups from across Donegal, from, you know, Letterkenny upwards and downwards, they can come to the centre.
Mm.
Groups can come in and as groups and learn to cycle on this full range of inclusive bikes. Right, that's what this is about. You know, it's brilliant and it's fun. Cycling should be fun. So why shouldn't the people with additional needs be included? And I think that's the vision of ourselves, the HSE, Department of Transport, Department of Children, and even Donegal County Council, who came and paid for actually the track itself. So kudos to them, you know?
Yeah. And does that mean you've had to train people up locally, Kevin? Because, I mean, some of this equipment, right, would require a little bit of knowledge in the first instance. So, you know, to welcome groups there and say, right, this is their equipment, this is how you use it and oversee it, that type of thing?
Well, with grassroots, we're partnering with grassroots. Mm. So grassroots have trained people on the ground.
Great.
So when the people come and visit, the people that's going to be trained people there to show them how to use the bike, work with them. So get people comfortable using the bike inside the centre. Obviously, it stays inside the centre. You know, there's no off-piste here or going outside. But they can come. So the whole idea is when we work with this now, that groups can come along. It's all paid. It's going to be free. For the groups, that be the number of hours we put in there, and they can enjoy cycling, but it'll all be supervised cycling. Mm. So there's not going to be individual. It's going to be supervised because, as you quite rightly said, Greg, these bikes are technical. Some of them are technical, a wheelchair bike, a hand bike. So when they're actually taught how to basically learn to use it themselves, then after a few hours or a few times, then they can cycle around on their own. So it's like what, as the saying goes, it's like learning to ride a bike.
Yes, and it quite literally is that. Yeah, indeed. Listen, it sounds fantastic. And the official launch of the Northwest of Ireland Hub for Variety Ireland will take place on Saturday, the 25th of July, 10:30 a.m. at Creven Terminal. A great opportunity to go along and see the facilities. I'm sure the invites have gone out, Kevin, as well. But
Everyone is welcome, Kevin. Is welcome. Come along, enjoy it, have the crack.
Listen, thanks so much, Kevin. Appreciate your time. That's Kevin O'Brien from Variety Ireland. Okay, we'll remind you of that maybe a little bit closer to the time. I'm living, this is about nudity. We were talking about a caller complaining that parents are allowing their children on the beach with no clothes on. It's not just parents. I'm living next door to a family and the lady next door sunbathes topless. I'm furious about it. I saw her out the window and was disgusted. It's not appropriate. I phoned the guards and they said there's nothing they can do as there's nothing. It is allowed. I have men in the house, so I don't like it. Right. I mean, obviously, it's not a guard matter and the person's on their own property. But I mean, if you've got next door neighbours and they're overlooking you, what do you do in that situation? I don't know if that's one for Seamus Gunn, but they're just boobs, aren't they? It's just a body. Like, is it that bothersome? I mean, the lads in your house are fine. They're not going to get too excited about it, I don't think. Or maybe it's an absolute disgrace. Again, I don't really know. Some of these things are not relevant to me, so I haven't really thought too much about it. Good morning, Greg. I'd like you to bring up the issue of the grass cutting along the dual carriageway in Letterkenny. It's a disgrace that they only cut a bit of it. Surely it would need to be cut as someone could lose their lives. Now, I'm not sure what how safety is affected by the grass up the dual carriageway. Let me know. I think whenever you put something into a road development that needs maintaining, you've made a mistake to begin with, you know, because you're going to have to close lanes to cut grass. It's the same with the four lanes there. You're going to have to close a lane to cut trees and make sure the trees aren't overhanging. It wouldn't be me. I know people like to try and make it look pretty, but I think you're creating a problem for yourself. Delighted to hear the government is considering banning e-scooters completely, says a listener. Yeah, okay, that's one view. Sinn Féin, their TD, Angus O'Shannady, he has a private member's bill to protect the copyright of Irish artists in the era of artificial intelligence, and it was recently debated in the Dáil. A prolific songwriter from Bangor is Ian Archer is with me now. Good morning, Ian. A pleasure to speak to you generally, but good to get your views on this important issue. How are you keeping?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on, Greg. It's great to be on the show and great to be talking about this, especially in the wake of such a great day this week in the Dáil. It was just wonderful to see TDs really get the message and support it.
What is the threat to songwriting or music from AI? Is it, you know, blurring the lines between what's real and not real? Is it stealing people's work? What are the main things you think in this era we need to be addressing, Ian?
Well, certainly it is those things. You know, from the outside of the problem through to the end result, you know, there are so many wonderful crafted songwriters and composers in the world creating human generated work. Seems ridiculous to have to clarify that. And what has been happening for a period of time that we have discovered is that the tech companies have been scraping that work and turning that into data that feeds the generative AI machines. And those generative AI machines are creating work which is flooding, is essentially flooding the market with AI created songs and compositions that at this point are quite substandard, but also are putting songwriters, and especially new and developing and aspiring songwriters and composers, out of a work and out of a marketplace. And you know, I think it's really important, even from the standpoint of just personhood and the work, that's upheld. But our asks are really simple. Basically the tech companies have been operating in a way which is completely unaccountable, and we haven't been asked, we haven't been remunerated, we haven't been paid anything for our work having been assimilated in the machine, and we haven't been given any information. So we want the work removed, and we want the option to be able to either opt in or keep our work out. We want transparency from the tech companies, and we want fair remuneration where the work.
Can the genie be put back in the bottle, though, Ian? Because it's, you know, it's you as a songwriter and your fellow songwriters, authors, you know, like AI, you have to input to get out, right? So all of your amazing work, really, without your permission, is being used. Now, if I were to nick one of your songs and sort of change a few lyrics or nick the melody or whatever it might be, you know, you can take me to court in relation to that, that it's tangible, right? But
correct,
we have this system now whereby these companies are making billions and it's stealing your work and your colleagues' work. And then how do you prove it? If it spews out a song similar to one of your tracks, where do you go? It's horrendous, really.
It is absolutely horrendous, but this seems to be a pattern where it's break things and apologize later. You know, the tech companies have been at this for a long period of time, and we have seen with the fixed streaming campaign, for one thing, that it takes a while. We have to really make a noise, but actually songwriters, especially via the organization that I play a part in, the Ivors Academy, have become very adept over the last number of years at making that noise, and have become good at getting the message through. And this is simply another front on which we're trying to work on behalf of songwriters and composers to get a fair deal and be heard, where we're all in our rooms working really hard and separated. It's difficult to fight these fights, but with an organization like Ivors Academy and Ivors Ireland, you know, I encourage all songwriters to sign up. You can sign up free in the Discovery tier and be a part of this. But this is the way to get the message across to the tech companies that they need to wake up and play fair and treat us well. In terms of the genie being out of the bottle, my point to that directly to the tech companies would be, apparently you own a supercomputer. It's not very difficult. Surely, if it's that good and you know, the stock market is floating on the genius of this machine or these machines, it can't really be that difficult for it to analyze its own work. So it could easily look at if it's used my work, own up to it and pay me for it. That would be a simple ask, surely, with a supercomputer.
Yeah, because I think there's two things going on. There's the material that was already out there being stolen and assimilated and being used for influence. But then there's the future. It's future songwriters or a song that you haven't written yet. You know, yes. I mean, if you write a song now, are you cautious as to how, where you put it or what you do with it next? Because, you know, there's nothing at the moment to stop it just being sucked into the machine as soon as it's put out there.
That's true, Greg. But at the same time, we can't be cautious about putting work into the world because that's how we make our livelihood. And really, that's being taken advantage of. And you're so right about new work. And one of the things that is, you know, really, really close to my heart is making sure that we have a really great ecosystem for new and developing Irish songwriters and composers. We're already in a really, really challenging world, and it can be very, very off-putting for young people to feel like they've got a viable future. That's where I want to see the law changed, actually. You know, eventually we need legislation, we need government to act on our behalf so that we do have a really, really positive environment for new songwriters and new composers.
And I think too, and I haven't really seen this discussed, maybe you have or you're right across the scene, but there's a, you know, I think radio particularly is paying the price now for its mistreatment of artists, you know, particularly in Ireland and how much exposure they get, but in Britain as well. And you're hearing DJs platforming AI and going, oh my, this is amazing and all that kind of stuff. Well, I think they really need to remember which side the bread is buttered on. And I think the likes of the music industry, those that broadcast the music, and the streaming platforms, who would be non-existent without the new music and back catalogue of brilliant artists, that they take a stand and not platform it either. And starve the market, because the tech companies aren't going to go near it if they can't make money.
Yes, and there's a whole world out there for the tech companies to help people with. You know, why do the fun stuff? Like, you know, there are many, many opportunities to be of real benefit to humanity, but stealing their, you know, heart and soul, really, really hard crafted songs is not the way to do it. Let's help humanity, not destroy their work. And, you know, it seems really, really abundantly clear the way to do this ethically. We just need to get the message through to the politicians and through to the EU that we need the support and ability to be able to fairly craft out our work. It's a great thing to do. I've had a great time doing it and still do and love writing songs. And you're right, putting new ones into the world and knowing that they're protected is it's the fundamental nature of this whole thing. Okay. That, you know, not much needs to happen. Copyright law is there. My works are copyrighted. If you write a song tomorrow, your work's copyrighted, you know, the moment you submit that and register it. And we just need that copyright law upheld for the tech companies. Right. And we have a future as songwriters. If we don't have that, and you know, the other day in Dublin, we had Danny O'Donoghue with us from The Script. Danny and I worked with Danny on his last record, producing a number of tracks for that. And Danny was saying he's, you know, he's aware of 125 of his songs that have been scraped for AI. I mean, this is one of the biggest Irish bands at a point where they're feeling like they really, really need change.
Brilliant stuff. Indulge me before I let you go, Ian. Give our listeners two of your the songs that you've written. I just introduced you as a songwriter, but help them understand your work.
Sure. Yeah. I wrote and received an Ivor Novello Award for the song Run by Snow Patrol, which was then taken to UK number one by Leona Lewis. It was the fastest selling UK download that year. And then I wrote Hold Back the River with Brilliant. James Bay, which I won another Ivor Novello Award for. And I'm writing them constantly. So let's go. I love writing songs.
I can assure you, listeners, there's a ton of songs that you've done all manner of things to, dancing and everything else to Ian's work. You're one of our most prolific songwriters. It's astonishing what you guys do. Listen, thank you so very much indeed. I really appreciate your time, and look after yourself.
Thanks for having me aboard.
Bye-bye. Cheers. Look after yourself, as I say, yeah. Ian Archer there. So he wrote Run. I think he did Chasing Cars as well, and a few others. He's fantastic, a fantastic songwriter. And I really can understand where they're coming from in terms of, you know, that's their work. And it's being used to influence what AI is putting out. And then people go, oh, well, AI, it's creating great music now. Well, of course it is, because it's stealing it off the likes of Ian and others. Now, the big conversation on the roads this week has been e-scooters. We heard the Taoiseach saying he might be minded to have a total ban. The head of An Garda Síochána maybe also agrees. And there are those who are dealing with the injuries in our hospitals that... Well, what we heard yesterday was that either enforcement or greater safety measures or a total ban. Dr. Peter O'Rourke is a retired consultant, orthopaedic surgeon and regular contributor to this show, which we really appreciate. And what's your views on all of this, Peter? Good morning to you.
Well, I think the government brought in some legislation about e-scooters 2 or 3 years ago, but it doesn't really seem to have helped. I think... there's a lot of new legislation is needed generally, I think, for road usage. You have delivery bikes in Dublin and bigger cities. They're tearing over the place. Are they insured? They're driving electric bikes as well. If you have an electric bike, never mind an electric scooter, if you're a pedestrian hit by one of them, you'll do every bit as much damage as a car. And I think there have even been a couple of fatalities in the UK where pedestrians have been hit by e-bikes. So I think that whole sector needs to actually be better legislated, and perhaps a conversation about road usage by other than cars and motorbikes, which seems to be the only place legislated at this moment.
Yeah, it's interesting because you're broadening out in an opinion piece. You're broadening out the conversation. Yes, let's talk about e-scooters. And when you hear that 6 children were treated in intensive care with severe life-changing head injuries, it's shocking. And that might motivate you to say, right, let's get shot of these. But you're also extending out to leisure cyclists, because maybe if we got a group of stats on the amount of, you know, road traffic collisions or injuries in a given weekend with cyclists, we might be equally shocked.
Well, I think the whole thing about cycling has changed. I mean, certainly when I was in college, I cycled to and from university because that was the only way I could. Nowadays, cycling has become a real leisure sport, and it's been promoted as a fitness thing by everybody. But these are the national road network we're talking about, not somebody's trail or going up a mountain path or something like that. This is a sport on a national road. I mean, there's outcry about silky racing on a national road and blocking it. Why is cycling as a leisure sport the only sport which is allowed to use our national roadworks? We don't have GAA games or basketball games in the middle of roads or along roads. I think in most other countries, they have a network of cycle paths, not necessarily part of the road, and you can do that. I think the road network should be used for transport purposes, and I would certainly have misgivings about using it for sporting activities in large groups, especially at weekends.
Right, so, I mean, we do see these groups, don't we, as you say, you know, 4, 10, 15 cyclists taking up the space of an articulated lorry, perhaps. But how do you differentiate between that group of individuals versus, you know, someone that's just cycling to work on the same road? Or would you say the same rules should apply?
I think if you're... most people don't dress up in Lycra to cycle to work and don't pack travel in groups of 10 or 20. I think if you're part of a leisure group, the question arises, should you even be on the road as a sporting activity? I have no problem sort of individual cyclists, cyclists using it for transport. But when you see a group of 20 cyclists, that it is impossible for a car to pass safely. And you mentioned an articulated lorry. An articulated lorry might safely pass one bike. It will not safely pass 20 bikes. And this potentially, unfortunately, in reality, causes frustration and could lead to accidents. So I think it is an area that is not legislated. And if the government are deciding to legislate on things like e-scooters, e-bikes, I think the whole conversation should be about regulations for all road users, as I said, not just cars and motorbikes.
Well, I mean, one thing would be that you insist that people ride bikes single file.
Well, the recommendation is to drive cycle two abreast as it's safer.
Yeah.
But again, on a Donegal country road, travelling two abreast, if a car tries to pass you, for them to give you the metre or metre and a half clearance means they're driving in the ditch on the other side of the road. There's practicality is about it, I think. The other thing is, we mentioned the e-scooters. E-scooters on a Donegal road, apart from in Letterkenny, would be, I think, pretty dangerous. And the other thing about e-scooters as well is if you hit a pothole in an e-scooter, your chance of coming off and ended up in the middle of the road are far greater than if you're, say, on a bicycle.
Tiny
so
wheels,
so
really.
So many factors.
Yeah, it's the smaller wheels. Yeah. So you would... You see, the problem with the all-light ban on e-scooters is that they open the floodgates and people are spending €300 or €400. It's the principal way for some to get to college, to work, it's independence, etc. Clearly, obviously, there are under 16s that shouldn't be on them and there are people who are using them irresponsible. And rather than trying to address that or fix that, our default is a total ban. Do you not think that, you know, really that in terms of the leisure cycling, but also the e-scooters, that we should look at licensing, road tax, insurance, you know, let's normalise it that way before we say that thing you spent £500 on is now worthless.
I agree with you totally. That's the whole point about carrying out legislation for all road users. I mean, not only is it it's the scooters, but the e-bikes. I mean, an e-bike can travel at 50k without any difficulty. I mean, a professional cyclist, the Tour de France yesterday averaged 50k per hour for 3 hours. So, you know, a sports cyclist can hit speeds of 50 or 60 kilometres quite easily. And if you have an e-bike cyclist, I'm sure they can hit similar speeds. So if you don't have, if you have a vehicle that's capable of doing 50 or 60 kilometres and they're unlicensed, uninsured, untaxed, there's a problem.
Yeah, true. And, you know, there's no speed limit. Someone could come down Largy Brack on a bike at 100. There's nothing to stop them doing it. But we won't do this. We'll choose the path of least resistance. Either do nothing or ban altogether.
Well, unfortunately, they brought in misconceived legislation 2 years ago, which opened the floodgates. So I think they need to do something now. And from hearing the Guard, the commissioner talking about the fact that they're used in the commission of crimes and intimidation, I think something has to be done about it. But the sale of these things needs to be limited. I mean, if you buy
a drone.
Okay. If you buy a drone now, you have to register it. You have to be licensed to use it, etc. And that is not going to hurt anybody. It's not going to cause anybody any injury. And it is legislated, it is governed, and it is restricted, and you can be fined for using it. I don't know if anybody has ever been fined for using an e-scooter, an e-bike, or any of these devices. I feel sympathy for the guards. I mean, they were talking about giving out the fact that the guards weren't trained how to apprehend these people. The guards have to be very careful, because if they chase anybody and the person has an injury, the guards are up before their investigative body. Yeah. They can't win.
Tied up with GSOC or its replacement for the next two or three years, I get you. Listen, always a pleasure. Let's see what the listeners think. Thank you so very much indeed. That's Dr. Peter O'Rourke, retired consultant orthopaedic surgeon. I suppose what's new in his comments is that he's saying effectively, you know, people as part of cycling clubs that go out and cycle on Donegal's roads and roads across the country, and they're wearing, you know, the sort of quasi-professional cycling gear, that they can cycle whichever way they like. They shouldn't be allowed on the roads in that manner, because you don't allow people to play GEA up the middle of the four lanes or on the N56 from Glenties to Dunloe. So why should they be allowed to partake in their sport on the public roads? So I throw it to you. 086 60 25,000. That's the WhatsApp and the text number. 086 60 25,000, or give us a call on 0749125,000. On e-scooters, having had a near miss with a child on an e-scooter recently, I beg parents to educate their children on the dangers of being on a main road. The child didn't even see me with his hood up, came right out onto the main road in front of me. I sat my hand on the horn with fright to alert the child. No apology, acknowledgement. That may seem tame to people, but it's affected me. If I'd hit that child, would he have been killed, seriously injured? The parents would automatically blame me, the driver. The child and my life would never be the same again. I felt, and I still feel sick, messaging this. Yeah, and, you know, maybe the child had headphones in and didn't hear you on the phone, on the horn. On the issue of roads, add into the complication of road safety, the overgrown hedges and trees are a big problem. On the issue of sunbathing, where exactly was this woman sunbathing topless, Greg, asking for a friend? Well, I didn't get that information for you. Right, well, the lady of the house next door is not happy. John Gallagher is director of Rathmullen, The Way Forward. Good morning, John.
Hi, Greg. Good morning. How are you?
Good to have you on the programme. Right, now, plans afoot to develop a small cruise ship strategy to explore Rathmullen's potential. And would this be sort of in a particular part of that market, John, to suit the area?
Well, Greg, you're probably too young to remember, but in back in the 60s, there used to be cruise ships used to come into Rathmullen. And as you know, Rathmullen was, during the First World War, it was a port for the Royal Navy back in the First World War. So there's a huge sort of maritime heritage here. And what we're trying to do is try to make use of the marine infrastructure we have here. And we can't, we don't want to compete with Killybegs and Dunleary, you know, those big, large cruise ships. So we're looking at small boutique cruise ships, expedition type cruise ships, up to maybe about 100 meters that we could accommodate along the pier in Rathmullen.
And those,
so using existing infrastructure.
Those boats and vessels are out there, are they? This is just like a case of tapping into that market?
Exactly, Greg. Those a lot of those ships are out there. And if you go to the Scottish Highlands, places like Tobermory, Port Ellen, Oban, Campbelltown, those cruise ships, there's maybe about 10 cruise ships that just go around all those ports. And the reality is that Donegal and Lossiewelly is only about 50 miles from Port Ellen, for example. So we're not very far off the existing route that cruise ships use. And also, if we can get cruise ships coming to Rathmullen, then there's no reason why they can't go to Torrey as well, why they can't go to Burton, Portnor and more. So we could create a whole new tourism sector here.
And what would the offering be? Now, you know, and it's obvious, right, but there's been a great deal of investment in that area in terms of the pier and what have you. But, you know, what would the selling point for these companies be to attract them to Rathmullen?
Well, that's a good question, Greg. These expedition type let's say, the passengers, it's very different from the mass cruise market. What these people are looking for, Greg, is they're looking for experiences. They want to know, they want to meet local people, they want storytelling, they want to understand the heritage of places, they want to see the culture and the heritage and hear about the history. They want to visit remote places like, say, Fanad Lighthouse, like the Knockawa Drive. They want the food experiences. They want to meet local crafters, local artists. They want to buy their locally produced products. So it's all very much experience-based, Greg. And that's why we have a consultancy called Runda who are putting together a proposition for us. And they are very experienced in putting together tourism-type experiences for all these, hopefully, passengers coming here.
And the idea is it that it would be controlled, that this would not necessarily, I don't know, can it become too busy in this area or this market, too much footfall? I don't know. What else do you think would need to be part of this plan to ensure that it doesn't disrupt other activity in Rathmullen, for an example?
Yeah, I mean, Rathmullen is very busy, as you can imagine, these days. The cruise season runs from May to October, so, you know, it's spread out. You know, it's not, it just doesn't happen in 1 week or 1 month, so it's spread from May to October. And typically, Greg, these boats would have maybe 100 to maximum 200 passengers. So the idea is that if people want to go on a bus tour, for example, Rathmullen is closer to Glenveagh than Killybegs, for example. It's a lot closer. If people want to go on bus tours, that can obviously be accommodated. But what we're about is trying to keep these passengers local.
That's what I was going to say.
So they can have local experiences. For example.
Yeah. No, you can give us the examples, but I think that's really important because we have seen elsewhere whereby, you know, we've invited cruise ships in, they land and they leave. So in other words, the amenities to dock one of these vessels are used locally, but then it's like, where do you go from there? You know, they're nowhere to be seen until they're reboarding. I think it'd be really critical, especially for the local buy-in, if this was seen as obviously people are going to go elsewhere too, but if this was seen as a benefit to Rathmullen. So you were going to say as to how that would be achieved.
Yeah, I can give you a good example of how we would see that working. For example, in one place in Scotland, the passengers come ashore, and you're talking maybe, say, 50 passengers who might opt for that particular tour. So these passengers come ashore. They're met by someone playing the Eland pipes, for example. You have the local craft market at the right there at the pier. They get taken on a nature walk. I don't know if you're familiar with Bat's Walks in mm-hmm. Rathmullen. It's you know, it's beautiful. Taken on a nature walk then, and they can go to Rathmullen House, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and have high tea in Rathmullen House, and then be taken back along the beach. Those are the types of experiences that passengers are looking for nowadays, and that keeps the passengers local and supports all the local businesses.
All right, now okay. So what happens next for these plans? As you say, you've a consultancy company, I think you said, are on board. What's next then? You know, what do you have to get the approval of the harbour master, the state? I don't know. How does something like this progress from here?
What we're doing, Greg, we're putting together a strategy. And the idea is that we come up with a cruise brochure, and the brochure will be targeted at the actual people and organizations that plan the itineraries for cruises. And that brochure will, as well as highlighting the sort of experiences that we can offer here locally in Rathmullen, it will also include all the technical information, all the how we overcome the regulatory issues for cruise ships coming in here. So it will be an all-encompassing document that will enable the people who define the itineraries for cruise ships to include Rathmullen on their itineraries.
All right.
Now, it's not going to happen this year. People have already planned the cruises for 2027. But once we can get that document out there, which we expect to happen in September, we will be able to start lobbying the people who organize the cruises.
All right, thanks, John. That's John Gallagher, director of Rathmullen, the way forward. And the issue was actually raised in March, I believe, in the council chamber. Councillor Padraig McGarvey, he proposed that the council's tourism sector seek expressions of interest from the cruise ship companies to use Rathmullen Pier as a dock. This is some of what he had to say to us at the time.
The pier ticks all the boxes. Rathmullen itself ticks all the boxes, and the wider area. It's the second deepest natural harbour in Ireland. 14 metres deep, so I suppose there's enough water there for large cruise ships and large vessels. So I suppose, and the services then on the pier as well. There's new services, the fresh water available. It has refuse disposal and access control as well. So it does tick all the boxes.
Yeah, indeed. That's what he said at that council meeting. I'm not sure what happened following that motion. But anyway, it was brought up at Letterkenny Milford Municipal District. We've got Rathmullen the way forward on board as well. So maybe, if you're in that area, let us know what you think. So we had heard from the Taoiseach, the Taoiseach's office, that he was agreeing to meet representatives of those who were affected by the Chrysler tragedy, principally those who lost loved ones. Now, confirmation has been given of a time and a date for that meeting. We're joined now by Hugh Harper. Hugh, thank you for chatting to me this morning. And confirmation, you received the confirmation yesterday. Welcome to news, I would imagine, Hugh.
Yeah, very welcome news, Greg. We look forward to travelling to Dublin to meet the Taoiseach and laying our concerns directly to him. And we wait to see what kind of response he's going to give us then.
It would seem that the government, as it stands, are pretty set on not progressing a judicial, statutory, independent public inquiry until such time as the Garda inquiry has concluded. Now, that could be, we just don't know how long that might be. And there is the sense that both of these could run side by side. How are you going to impress on the Taoiseach that he needs to move forward with this inquiry?
Well, you made a couple of valid points there, Greg, but I suppose we should say what length is a piece of string. How long is this investigation going to take? And I want to clearly state that we support the Garda investigation along with the HSE. But one thing that stands out, we've given the government every opportunity to establish a public inquiry. They maintain that it can't happen while there's a Garda investigation ongoing. And we understand that. But they've never offered to establish a public inquiry at any other time. And this is the ongoing argument back and forward between ourselves and government representation.
And it's not just either, and just to be clear, and listeners, I hope are up to speed on this, but perhaps will not be, that of course this is about finding out answers that will not be discovered as part of a Garda investigation per se. But this is about potentially saving lives today, tomorrow and the day after, and I think particularly in the context of the Gas Safety Amendment Bill. So this isn't just about Chrysler, even though that is as important as it is. This is actually about saying, well, let's not wait until we see a similar incident or worse elsewhere.
You're right, Greg. We need a wider investigation, one that highlights any faults or failings outside of the criminal investigation. We have identified multiple gas explosions and gas-related incidents over the past decade. And this is not directly in line to do with the Chrysler explosion, but it's a preempt for us. When you talk about the Gas Safety Amendment Bill, what a lot of people don't know, when you read through the fine print, that in that piece of legislation that's been brought forward as an amendment to that legislation, there's a grandfather clause included in that. And for me and for my family and for other families, that's an insult into the deaths of the 10 people killed within the tragedy of Chrysler. To allow gas systems to run unregulated, unlicensed, without legislation, after the tragic scenes within Chrysler that killed our daughter Leona and 9 others, 3 of them children, you have to start asking questions. Have the government learned from this?
Mm.
Questions that include the CRU known for 10 years since 2016 unlicensed premises were operating outside of statutory regulation and legislation, and they're willing to allow that to happen now in 2026 with a grandfather clause and new amendment. it doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up.
No, it doesn't make sense, to be honest with you. Like, say, for instance, in the space of aviation, if there was a plane crash and there were question marks over, you know, the pilot, but also there were question marks over an engine in that aircraft, you would have a Garda investigation, but instantly you would have an air accident investigation that would begin immediately. And the reason it would happen immediately was, say, for instance, there was a fault in a particular plane engine. You'd want to identify that fault and take every plane out of the sky until such time as all of those planes were safe. That's standard. That's already there. The same would happen in buses or whatever it might be. So if you break, if you take the emotion out of it, and I'm not mean you, I mean the listener here, of course you, like, obviously, if you had a situation whereby you have a fault in the system or a fault in equipment, you instantly do a full investigation of that at the same time as to find out if anyone is criminally responsible, because you don't want to see this replicated elsewhere. You don't sort of say, all right, well, maybe there'll be another major gas explosion, but we can't really deal with that at the moment because we have to find out if someone else didn't do something and there's a criminal element to it. So I'm explaining it like that, Q, to try and really put it out into the open how ridiculous this strategy is.
Yeah, there's an element of that, Greg. And again, it's hard to understand the thinking of the government. I mean, we've seen statutory public inquiries run side by side with Garda investigations. And, for example, I always go back to Raglan House in Dublin in 1987, where unfortunately two people were killed. Through that, there was an establishment of a Garda investigation, a coroner's inquest. But within a few days of that investigation, a member of government established an inquiry into what actually happened in Raglan House. And from that, Greg, within 4 months, a file had been completed and given to government. And within a year, they identified buildings within the Greater Dublin area and proceeded with remedial changes to stop progressive collapse mm-hmm. within these buildings. I don't understand the thinking. I respect the idea of regarding investigation, health and safety investigation. You shouldn't be harmed or threatened in any such way, you know, if and such an advanced place that we're at.
Mm.
But how long do we need to go with this while there is systems out there, gas systems out there that pose a potential risk to the public?
Right, okay. Go ahead,
Hugh. They haven't been identified. Nobody knows where they are, and the government are willing to run along with us.
Right, well, at least you'll get to be able to, you have these questions formulated, you know the details, you can put it straight to the Taoiseach, and hopefully the penny drops and he's able to give you some replies in relation to that. So obviously, Hugh, will be touching...
You know,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, we you know, in our work, we've gathered a lot of information. We've spent a lot of time with this. There's a lot of stuff that we've uncovered that we don't just want to bring to light yet. We want to put this directly to the Taoiseach. We want to have an open and transparent meeting with him. And when we leave government buildings that day, we want to be able to come out inside and state clearly to the media that we have been given promises.
Mm.
And preferably in writing that a public inquiry will be established. Maybe we're flexible on the timing of that, but we want to come out and we want to be honest and truthful with the media, and we'll see where we'll go from there.
All right, listen, thanks very much for that. I do appreciate your time. Hugh Harper there, who lost his 14-year-old daughter, Leona. And they will get to sit down with on Taoiseach, and fair play to the Taoiseach for agreeing to that meeting, and we'll see what comes from that. You know, like, and then you'd wonder if there is a commission. Now, a public inquiry is different from a report, but we're still waiting for the Mulcahy report to be published. That was conducted and put together, and then you wonder the reasons as to why that hasn't been published. And then you wonder people might think, well, maybe for the that's why we don't want to do public inquiries, you know, because people could be found culpable or responsible or whatever. But we'll see what Auntie Shock, Micheál Martin, has to say to the families when that meeting takes place. Okay, we say good morning and congratulations to Dr. David Friel, lecturer in social care practice, FHEAI and PhD candidate 2026. Well done to you, David. Dr.
Greg,
David.
Good morning.
You're not going to make me call you doctor, are you?
I don't know. I have to use it like a shield now. Worked very hard for it, Greg, huh?
As I say, this is a fantastic achievement for you. The phraseology here, defending my PhD, what does that actually mean in real terms? Because it sounds like a sport.
Yeah, well, what happens is you work 4 years over this project doing research, and it all comes down to a 4 or 5 hour viva, which basically you have to go in and defend your research in terms of what you found, the theories that you used, the methods that you used. So I had two professors from the UK that were flown over to examine me. And I was listening earlier on for a short period of time around AI. And I suppose higher education is not unaffected by it as well. And I think there's a precedence in vivas in terms of examining individuals' knowledge. Now, that's not to say that we all can articulate knowledge really well, but I think we're living in very fragile times. And I think AI can do a lot of good, but it's definitely posing a lot of challenges. And that's the same in the production of music, it's the same in the production of knowledge. And kind of when you're doing research and so on, the AI is scraping the internet and taking that information. So that's what it's defending, Greg. You're defending what you found and kind of the whole kind of approach that you took to the research process.
Yeah, indeed. And whilst obviously it is a huge personal achievement, it is also incredibly significant because if you see it, you can be it, right? This is, you've become the first member of the traveller community to complete your PhD through the Atlantic Technological University Northwest of Ireland. Mm. So that's important to you, isn't it, to be an inspiration that those for those in your community that come behind you?
Yeah, and I think Greg, it's a privilege on one hand, but it's a call to action on another. To my knowledge, I'm the fifth person from the community to ever undertake and complete a PhD. We are very much on the margins of education. Our statistics that we're all well versed in now at this stage are extremely low. And what I would hope that it'd probably speak more to just not only travellers, but to a lot of students and a lot of young people who are sitting in the classroom and feeling, what does a person like me do in a place like this? And I think that's along a spectrum of individuals who are within our education system. And the education system, unfortunately, and research has proven this time and time again, is created and maintained for one type of people to succeed. If you look at people with disabilities, if you look at travellers, you look at Roma, all those marginalised in society, the statistics are appalling, you know.
Mm. Now, I mean, it's not even too, though, about inspiring the individual. Because, you know, the intelligence representation in the traveller community is going to be the exact same as in the wider community, but it's about embracing it and enhancing it and then allowing it to flourish, okay? So I suppose this is throw out there to the state or the agencies and also, you know, mums and dads in the Irish traveller community to sort of make sure that all of those agents can come together and realise the potential of young traveller people.
Yeah, and I think, Greg, what you just said there is, you know, my thesis looked at racism, and particularly during COVID. I know COVID seems like so far away now, but it was a critical social moment in our society, if you think about Black Lives Matter and all these things that happened. But in Ireland, what we have is a very good record of policy making. We write the most beautiful policies in terms of what we're setting out to do. The difficulty is the implementation, and it's always a deficit. So, and what happens then, for many reasons, on the ground, as you said, individuals who are wrapped around a young person or an individual, they fail to see the potential of that individual in terms of their life circumstances. And I have to say, while there's been some improvements across the spectrum, and particularly for travellers and education, we really have to critically reflect on our position in society. Mm. And I think we're in a current climate, Greg, and I'm sure you're well aware, because every time I turn on the radio, there's conversations about it. How our society's changing, conversations about that. I'm not racist, but I think we have to really critically reflect on where we are and critically reflect on our relationship in terms of travellers. Like, there's nearly this sentiment at the moment when I listen to people that racism is new to Ireland, that we have racism without racists, you know? And I find that a very difficult sentiment
to
understand.
What work does the community have to do, the traveller community have to do? Like, say, for instance, I don't know what percentage of the traveller community is settled now. Do you know borderline what it is?
Well, see, there's a very good a very good word in itself, but yeah, majority.
I'm only using phraseology that that I've learned, and you can correct me where it's wrong there. But all I'm saying is that I remember when I was going to school, I was acutely aware of the way the traveller community or parts of the traveller community used to live. There would be young people in the community and then they'd go somewhere else. And so at that time, it would be difficult to sustain, you know, an education because you'd be in St. Eunan's National School one day and then maybe in a school in Buncrana the other. And as I say, wherever I'm getting this wrong, you correct me. So that would be understandable why it might be more difficult to sort of, you know, maintain a presence in education. What I'm saying is there any cultural hangover from that, even when children are primarily maybe reared in the one area, that also within the community itself needs work done?
Well, beyond my own research, there has been research time and time again that with traveller parents that has said that they want their children to engage in education. And just in relation to the accommodation status of travellers, a majority of travellers now live in housing, so bricks and mortar housing.
Yes.
There's still a large proportion that live on traveller appropriate accommodation. But I get that a lot. Are you a settled traveller?
Yeah, but that means, but to me, what I'm saying, and then you can tell me what you hear.
Yeah.
Right? Because you remember, we have to say traveller with a T, and we have to,
right,
the capital T, and we have to get all our words right, and we don't want to say anything that's offensive. I'm only reflecting a word that your dad would have used, right? I'm only using that word back because I've learned from sitting in this chair. So when I say settled, what I'm saying is no longer with the
nomadic,
nomadic. That, and for me, the opposite of nomadic is settled. Now, of course, I'm fully aware that the members of the community are living in houses, but what's the alternative phrase?
Yeah, so if I could explain, we would name the dominant population, the likes of yourself, as a settled person, a non-traveller.
Right.
Okay. And the term settled traveller kind of arose from, well, you're kind of more like us. You're kind of a more appropriate or kind of palatable traveller.
But that's not what I think.
And what I always say to people is, it doesn't matter if you put a cat into a doghouse, it'll always be a cat. You know, being a traveller is far more than just living in a house, and we have a language, we have a culture, we have values.
Yeah, but you're missing the context to my question.
The context was that now
you would have a 13-year-old member of the traveller community is far more likely to be consistently within the same school. And my question to you was that, you know, is there a cultural hangover of the more nomadic lifestyle whereby within the community more could be done to get that child into school and more consistently in schools? You get where I'm coming from?
No, because if we look at early childhood care and education, for example, Greg, there's a high level of participation of traveller children. There's a high level of participation of traveller children right up to junior cert. It's approximately 70%. The fall off is when it comes up to leaving cert. It's about 31% of travellers completed. And then particularly if they do their leaving cert to third level education. So I don't think that there's any kind of applications.
What's happening at 15 then?
If you look at the experiences of travellers in education, Greg, I'm 28 years old, and that's not that, subjectively, not that old. I went to a travel-only Crescent preschool, and then I went into mainstream schooling. I have experiences that are unbelievable in terms of my primary school experiences, my secondary school experiences, and my third-level school experiences. Traveller children and traveller students are still experiencing that now. For example, travellers are overrepresented in reduced timetables, which basically means they're sent to school from 9 to 12. The school signed them in for the full day, just like it's the statistics that they're in the full day, but actually they're not. When it comes to racism against traveller children, it's never seen as that kind of bullying aspect. it's always seen and minimized in terms of its impact and what is happening in the school. And there's really low expectations. And that's not me speaking as a member of the community. That's me telling you what the research says. Mm-hmm. Research with people of the teaching profession say that they have really low expectations of travellers. Just kind of touching on what you just said a second ago, they're not going to stay anyway. They're going to move. They're going to get married. They have a preference for work. And all them low expectations infiltrate the way that you teach someone. Mm-hmm. I teach my students as a lecturer, and I would hope they can achieve beyond and above anything else. And that self-belief then has an impact for how that individual engages in the mm-hmm. learning, but more importantly, the outcomes in the learning.
So, of course, that there is no doubt then that system needs to change, and the teachers are off school at the moment. It'll be interesting to get their insight in relation to that. But my point is, and it's like everything in society, and you referenced earlier on about how society is changing. You know, I think we get where we need to go when we meet halfway. And I'm just wondering, what do you think the traveller community need to be doing better, okay, to be able to put even more pressure on the broken system?
Well, the way I look at it is, and it's funny, I teach a module called Equality and Social Justice. And very similar, we have debates all the time. It's really good to be in dialogue and to really critically think, the students to critically think about inequality in our society. And I always say to them, would you say that to a person with a disability? Would you say to a person 100%. With a disability, you have to fight harder in order for the system to accept you?
I wouldn't say you have to. No, of course not. What I would say is, if we say, for instance, have an influx of people of a different culture, okay, mm-hmm. I believe that people of that culture need to organise and reach out and recognise that, OK, there might be a culture shock here. What can we do? How do we better integrate? What can we maybe change about our perceptions of life or women or religion to make it feel like that we're not a threat to you? So I'd say the exact same thing to anyone, you know.
There's an assimilation undertone to that, Greg, that you have to somewhat leave a part of yourself in order for the majority of society
there isn't actually. And do you know what? Yeah, actually, because if I go to Dubai, I'm not walking around Dubai topless, right?
But I suppose...
I know if I do, I'm offending people in Dubai, and I could get sanctioned for it. It doesn't mean I'm any less of a person. It doesn't mean I'm not a Catholic anymore. It doesn't mean I'm not a man. It means that I understand that I have to respect them and they will respect me. So that's an example. So every time you sort of said, I've given you an exact example of what I'm trying to say. Do you get me, Dave?
Yeah, but I think what's really important is context is very important for content. And we're talking about a community that's Indigenous to Ireland. And I was just thinking when you're saying there, what can the community do? Since the 1990s, there's been travel organisations set up across this country that have lobbied at many instances for the likes of the Equal Status Act, the Employment Equality Act, who have supported the traveller community. I don't see any culture clash in relation to travellers and accessing their basic rights, or what does travellers have to do in order to access or to be worthy of their rights in the society. I see that there's a fundamental problem with our society. We have to look very critically at why some groups of our society have mass inequalities.
Okay, I'll give you an example, right? What I'm saying is maybe, and this may be already happening, okay? So if we can identify a school where traveller children are going in for 3 hours but have been signed in for the day and this information is given, being gone for too slow. Well, let's organise whereby we get representative of the traveller community and the other communities, whatever the right phrase is, go into that school and say, this is unacceptable. We have a group of young children here who are the exact same as the other children. Why are you? Explain to us why they're being... So, in other words, rather than simply being the victim of it, right? What can we do and use our friends in all communities to go in and challenge that and get an explanation, right?
But that's happening, Greg. Tusslet done a massive review of the use of reduced timetables and found that travellers and people with disabilities were the most affected by this practice that wasn't being reflected into the national policy or guidance.
That's a disgrace.
But what happens is, and we see it across, who holds the power? It's a little bit like the defective concrete blocks. Any of our societal issues, we might form as a collective in terms of resistance and highlight the discrepancies that are happening there. But at the end of the day, if it's the local authority or if it's the school or if it's the Gardaí, they're the individuals that hold the purse strings and the power within our society. Okay. So I accept what you're saying. There, of course, there's a responsibility in any community to mobilise, to collectivise. But I, what I wouldn't accept is that we can push any kind of huge responsibility for a structure broader, on a marginalised community.
But I was clear, and I said it's the broader community. See, this is the point I'm saying is that... Yeah. It wouldn't just be the members of one community, because instantly that indicates that there's some sort of separation or differentiation. And it is all fascinating. And you know what? You are the person that's done the research on this with your work. And it's fantastic that it's been defended as it has.
Yes,
and it's fantastic that these conversations are happening in the classrooms as well, too.
It changes the nature and I have to say, just to thank obviously my parents and my wife and my family, but also individuals within the ATU, because I done my undergrad in ATU, done my master's in ATU, and done my PhD in ATU, and they've been very good to me. And that doesn't mean that the system has changed, because then sometimes it's like the poster child. But what it does mean is that there's small incremental change. And hopefully that will continue to be very positive for members of the traveller community.
Brilliant. Well done. Dr. David Friel, look after yourself. Thanks very much indeed.
Business Matters is proudly sponsored by Print Supplies Frosses. Fed up waiting days for an engineer to service your printer or photocopier? Tired of running out of ink? Print Supplies keeps your office running smoothly with managed print solutions, local Donegal support and remote monitoring. Print Supplies helps save your business time and money.
There you have it. All right, Chris, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
How are you keeping?
Very good.
Excellent stuff. Right, the Business Matters podcast from Highland Radio is released later today for you to listen at your leisure on our website or wherever you get your podcasts, and it's on the radio. We'll remind you of that a little later on. Now, really, you're getting in at the start here. You're not jumping on a bandwagon. You're not sort of hooking your trailer to a already well-established multi-million euro business. You're getting in there at the beginning, Chris, aren't you?
Yes, first up on this week's Business Matters. Look, when it comes to designing a home, be it a bedroom, bathroom, kitchen, bedrooms, living rooms, whatever, bear in mind, you know, what do you do if you have somebody in your house who has special needs, maybe a disability, elderly or frail? You know, there's more to take into things. Well, that's where interior designer Elaine Fitzgerald and occupational therapist Martha Hume come in. Now, they have set up a new company, Era Collective, and they have joined forces to help people when it comes to accessible home design. So, you know, could it be something like a ramp or holding rails, or maybe you have a child with sensory needs, and just to be thinking outside the box, bringing in colour, new design.
The position of handles and your kitchen doors.
Exactly.
Stuff that you wouldn't be expected to necessarily know, per se.
And sometimes it can be quite bland what you get. So they're bringing this to a new level, and we've a clip here. We'll hear from Elaine first and then from Martha.
We just felt like there was a huge gap in the market for accessible design in your own home, in businesses that's not clinical and that doesn't feel like you're in a nursing home. So we wanted to bring kind of design-led solutions to accessible design. And that's essentially what we do.
We had a big conversation when we set up the Era Collective. And one thing I was really strong on is I want to change the narrative. It's not a housing adaptation, it's a home redesign. Because we redesign our homes throughout our life course. It's about the functional use of the house. You know, you need to make a home that works for you. And as you get older, or if something is to happen and, you know, your kind of abilities change, your house needs to be redesigned to match that.
Yes, and what I like, it needs to be redesigned so that it is your home and it can be beautiful and functional, and it's not adaptation, it's redesign.
Absolutely.
I like the way they're thinking. It sounds fantastic. Yeah.
And Elaine was recently, she went to a trade show in Milan, and, you know, she said her eyes were opened and things that we may not even consider about.
And tech's coming into it as well, and I'm sure they're incorporating
absolutely.
That as well, the smart tech and how that can help you as well.
Yeah, so could be very, very interesting, the one to watch.
Brilliant.
Era Collective.
They spell that E-Y-R-A.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So it might sound like Era, as in E-I-R-E, but it's E-Y-R-A if you want to search that. Fair play. Good luck to those two ladies. They sound like they're right on the ball. And we have another young lady who is potentially right on the ball as well.
Yes, Amy McDade from Buncrana. She has set up a small business called Bold Blossom, and she makes very distinctive crocheted handbags. And she recently launched her website. She works part-time in a cafe, but this little business is really beginning to take off. And she explains more about it in this clip.
So I spent months researching materials, because taking pictures of the outdoors and using the outdoors as my theme, I can't really be going and using really badly processed and made materials. So I found a fantastic cord. So every single bag is made from 100% recycled cotton yarn. This is created using reclaimed clothing and textile product waste. It's wound on a biodegradable paper spool, and the dye is without any harmful chemicals. So, yeah, I just felt like this was the best kind of way to go forward to make sure that my products are really good for the environment, especially if the beautiful landscapes of Inishowen is going to be my inspiration. So yeah, every bag is handmade by me, stitch by stitch. There is no two that are exactly the same. One of the things that I kind of love about handmade work is that each piece is personal, and the cord itself is really, really cool. It's like a really big, chunky cord. It's a 9 millimeter cord, so it makes like the pieces really unique, and it's kind of like a statement piece for your outfit.
Yeah, indeed. Sounds fantastic. And there's a lot of those brilliant businesses, and that's what's great about your podcast, Chris. A lot of those business, brilliant businesses that are well established, but are also popping up and be hugely popular locally, but a huge sort of attraction internationally and nationally as well. And I'm sure that's what Amy's going to tap into.
Absolutely, and opening new doors by having a website now, you know, going from a local customer base to potentially anywhere on the planet.
Right, Chris, listen, the podcast is available for people later today. It'll just pop up on our website, but also Spotify, Apple Podcasts, as well. So subscribe and listen there, and broadcast this evening, Chris. Not this evening, Sunday evening.
Sunday evening after the 6 o'clock news.
And what about if someone wants to send abuse to you? What's the best way to do that if they want to do it
through,
by email?
Through yourself.
No, any feedback, no. Suggestions, etc.?
The email address is best, and it's businessmatters@highlandradio.com.
Chris, continue to enjoy the good weather. Get your dog a little pair of shoes. Isn't that the solution?
Yes.
All right. Thanks very much indeed, Chris Ashmore there. That's where we leave it on the programme today. Have a wonderful day, everyone.